The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning. Yeah, nice to see a lot of familiar faces. So, at a recent retreat on the East Coast, the retreat was closing, and we were all in this, like, it was a big group. It was over 100 people, and we're in a big circle in this cathedral hall, and this. Yeah, like super high ceilings, and there was so much energy coursing through the system, you know, and maybe you know that experience from the end of retreat when it's like just this kind of amorphous mass of undifferentiated intensity and feeling. Yeah, is that familiar? And it's like all these different feelings are running through the body, and they tend to be sort of take on. They get pointed in a particular direction, and they become sometimes about just one thing. And a lot of times they point towards a certain kind of devotion, right? And so it struck me in that moment, like looking at that group, that that if we had wanted to start a cult, we basically would have run the retreat in exactly the same way we did, you know? And maybe that's a weird opening to a Dharma talk. You can just relax. This is not my coup, you know, my IMC coup happening. You know, what we do ask people to do on retreat of being in silence, of surrendering, of letting go, of like any doubt, let that go, right? Of just the kind of beautiful healing effects of actually moving through what's often a challenging experience together. Like there, that bonds groups and right, we see like in various corners of our culture, like the kind of rituals around that are roughly like hazing that actually serve to cohere groups together, and then of course people have expended a lot of like self-regulatory energy in doing retreats, right? So just to stay with the schedule and sit and walk and get up early and go to bed late and do all these things to stay with the practice, like that's strengthening for us in the long run, but in the short term it's depleting. And one of the kind of well-known phenomena is like of the kind of that kind of depletion is it lowers our defenses and the mind becomes more suggestible. And so I say all of this as a kind of prelude to some reflections on surrender and power and sila conduct in Dharma, and how we relate to those themes in our own practice, how we relate to teachers and institutions and sanghas along these lines. And so it's a tricky situation because in a lot of ways we're asking for, like the Dharma asks for, a very deep kind of surrender. And we're also becoming, as there's a phrase that Gil likes, independent in the Dharma, right? And so there's this sort of like interesting juxtaposition between surrender, letting go of control, and also developing self-reliance and confidence in one's own heart and mind. In many religions, surrender is a central theme. And this is from Augustine's Confessions. It says, "We are but a particle of thy creation. Thou awakest us to delight in thee praise, for thou made us for thyself, and our heart is restless until it is in repose with thee. Hide not the face from me. Let me die, lest I die. Only let me see thy face. Narrow is the mansion of my soul. Enlarge it, that thou may enter in." So this is from theistic tradition. What does it mean to surrender in the Dharma? Surrender to the Dharma. We can first observe how our relationship to power, to letting go, it's double-edged. Like on the one hand, we can see the kind of thirst to hold on power, to exert power, right? To exert our autonomy and control. And so famously, like the philosopher Nietzsche says, "A living being wants above all else to release its strength. Life itself is the will to power. And animals strive instinctively for an optimum combination of conditions which allow them to expend all their energy and achieve their maximum feeling of power." So that's one side. But then there's another side where there is, it seems like, a tendency in human beings to want to maybe give up their power to ideas or figures or institutions, maybe as a way of affirming oneself. But there's a certain kind of letting go of power. And so I call on, to illustrate this, I call on the Onion, I try to work into every Dharma talk. So for those uninitiated to the Onion, it's like this satirical newspaper that is like a total joke and like deadly serious too, right? And so this is from 2013, and it's not speaking to, you know, the current geopolitical realities. But so from 4 years ago, the title was U.S. Citizenry Admits It Could Kind of Go for Charismatic Authoritarian Dictator. According to a Pew Research Center poll conducted this week, the overwhelming majority of Americans admitted they would actually be fairly interested in having a magnetic, forceful dictator oversee and control all aspects of American society. Citing the relative simplicity of the citizen's role in a totalitarian state, the U.S. populace said it could definitely see itself supporting a decisive iron-willed demagogue with citizens agreeing that the idea of entrusting all political, economic, social, and military decisions to a single bold despot actually sounded, quote, pretty good. So we do see like a phenomena of like, submitting in a lot of ways, but it's complicated. So sometimes this is a kind of sensitive territory, and that, like, even just the word surrender is very evocative, I think, for myself included. And in part because we've found that we have a history, a past of having, you know, to surrender to unwise people or, you know, unkind people or institutions. We're surrendering, being at the mercy of certain cultural mores and prejudice. And infuses our sense of like what power is and how we can use it, how we can relate to it. And surrender has not been like natural for me at all. I can remember it like very strong anti-establishment ideas like coursing through my body at age 12, you know, like, and I was annoying then. That was before I got a hold of French philosophy in college and became like totally intolerable. So this is a kind of, it's a kind of foreign thing for me. And entering the path, I sort of like, you know, just very slowly was like dipping my toe in and making sure that I had a deep confidence that it was actually safe to surrender to my teachers, to the path, to the practice. And my heart needed a very a lot of evidence that it actually that the way power was held in the Dharma was for the liberation of those practicing it, not for those holding it. Yeah. So in our practice, I think for a long time, often we try to, as I was just saying, like we try to control how deeply we let the Dharma seep in. You know, we try to actually both engage Dharma and in a certain way protect ourselves from it, because it's not clear how safe it is to let go deeply. And that mode of practice, it can bring fruit, it really can. But I think the deepest fruit of practice actually is dependent on a very deep gesture of surrendering. And to me, I often hear, I'm both like in the kind of Buddhist world and then also very deeply involved and committed to the secular mindfulness and the dissemination of those practices. And I often hear the critique that the secular mindfulness leaves out sila, that's what's left behind from Buddha Dharma in the translation into secular mindfulness practices is sila, ethical conduct. And I've never found that to be the case. That I think sometimes explicitly and sometimes implicitly, there's a very like deep current of ethical wisdom woven into the fabric of secular mindfulness discourses. So that feels quite present to me. Maybe what the main differentiator is that in secular mindfulness, there's less request for renunciation and surrender. Yeah. It's the degree of kind of like letting go it's just articulated. It's the practice is a more circumscribed practice. There's less of a request to let go, to surrender to the practice. Whereas in the Dharma scene, teachers essentially ask for our whole life, you know. That's the request. Like, so there's a certain kind of learning that happens when we are letting go of control. But maybe a certain kind of learning that uniquely happens when we're letting go of control, when we're no longer trying to govern the nature of our spiritual growth, you know? Like, our normal approach is like we like are going to build our spiritual progress and liberation piecemeal, you know, and kind of like do it under our own authority. But the Dharma is more than we bargain for. And we can't actually do it in that kind of measured control way. There's certain kinds of growth that only happen when the ego is all out of moves. You know? And so mindfulness and the practice really it gets richest when we don't know what to do anymore, and we have like less and less interest in exerting authority over experience, over our path, and we're released into a kind of realm of real like wonder and vitality, where it's like we don't even know if we've ever practiced before. We might have practiced for decades, but in this moment it's like this kind of just like totally coursing with vitality, because we don't know what to do. We don't know how to be with this experience. And we're willing not to know. We're willing to surrender in those moments. Mindfulness itself is a kind of surrender. We're letting go of control and ownership over experience. Right? The sense of like, we know, sometimes even just sitting, there's a way in which we're molding and shaping our experience. We're like exerting this subtle manipulative pressure on experience, right? And then maybe you also know what it's like to totally let go and to be kind of stand like totally naked, undefended in the face of the moment. To open the heart so deeply to experience that it just flows through. You know, many, many times on retreat, it's sort of like almost everything in me was saying no, except something in my heart, you know? And it's almost like a kind of art of learning to open to that part that's like still feels safe enough to let go, to surrender. So this is Adyashanti using who's I don't know his teachings well, and emphasizes surrendering to the teachings, surrendering to the moment, and uses some colorful language here. Says, if you prefer smoke over fire, then get up now and leave. For I do not intend to perfume your mind's clothing with more sooty knowledge. No, I have something else in mind. Today I hold a flame in my left hand and a sword in my right. There will be no damage control today, for God is in a mood to plunder your riches and fling you nakedly into such breathtaking poverty that all you will be left, that will be left of you, will be a tendency to shine. So don't just sit around this flame choking on your mind, for this is no campfire song to mindlessly mantra yourself to sleep with. Jump now into the space between thoughts and exit this dream before I burn the damn place down. Moment by moment, we surrender. Yeah. Mindfulness is a kind of letting go. Yeah. Letting go of control, of ownership. You know, that very sometimes subtle but pervasive sense of ownership, owning the body, owning the mind, owning experience, owning our future. You know, and then we sit and we're asked to let go of everything, to know everything as nature. It's not belonging to anyone. And we're asked to surrender to teachers, right? And, you know, different traditions and different teachers within each tradition make different kind of requests of the nature of the surrender, right? And, you know, in this tradition, it's a kind of migrated away from a kind of guru model and more into the model of, you know, Kalyanamitta, spiritual friendship, and less of a kind of hierarchical relationship. And there's a kind of sea change, I think, that we're like undergoing, not just in the Insight tradition, but in a number of Buddhist traditions, where there's a move to acknowledge the fallibility of teachers, right? To like stop rationalizing the imperfections of teachers. And there's been like so much harm that's been done in the insistence on having this idealized version of what a teacher is, you know. And for me, it's you know, been quite poignant and disturbing and transformative to see the misuse of power in teachers. and the way in which you know, power is if power is being used for anything other than the burgeoning freedom of the student, it's being misused, you know. And yeah, so there's a change happening, and at the same time, we can err on the side of holding it too tightly, of being too hierarchical, and also being too too loose. Also, yeah. And so, the like teacher-student relationship is boundaried in part because no matter how much we want it to be a democratic kind of playing field, there is an imbalance of power. There is a kind of the grounds are very fertile for idealization and projection. And part of the job of the teacher actually is to use that in ways that are conducive to the unfolding of the practice of students. And I've come to kind of appreciate that there's a certain kind of need sometimes for an idealized vision of the teacher, you know. And sometimes in the past I'd be very kind of dismissive of that and just want, you know, like my attempt would always be like, okay, let's cut through the projection to, you know, like immediately. I'm not going to tolerate that at all. But over time, I've come to appreciate that for some people, at some points in the unfolding of their path, it's actually supportive to have a kind of idealized vision of what a teacher is. And that means that we actually have to dance very carefully with these themes around power. It's incredibly a kind of sensitive terrain, you know, of power. And one of the things that it implies is that, you know, in the student-teacher relationship, this sila becomes, like, essential, yeah? A kind of commitment to non-harming. And in the imbalance of power, for, you know, that is one of the things that happens is that there's sometimes a kind of the way that imbalance of power gets sexualized. When I think back, like, why have there been so many so much harm done in spiritual circles with, you know, in like the misuse of sexuality? Why is there such a clear prohibition against any kind of sexual relationship between teachers and students? You know, I think part of that testifies to the way in which that zone of intimacy and power imbalance can be sexualized, you know? And the way in which that kind of, there's a certain kind of allure in that realm of power. And that's something that needs to be held, like, exquisitely, I feel, by teachers. So Tanissaro Bhikkhu elucidated like some qualities for actually assessing teachers, evaluating teachers, like in a way to assess whether you can trust their power. So he says, does the teacher's actions betray any of the greed, anger, or delusion that would inspire them to claim knowledge of something they didn't know, or tell another person to do something that was not in the person's best interest? To look how well do they handle adversity, to assess virtue in day-to-day activities and purity in the teacher's dealings with others, to look at their relation to precepts. Does this person make excuses for breaking the precepts, bringing themselves down to their level of behavior, bringing the precepts down to their level of behavior rather than lifting their behavior up? Power is always operating, you know. It's like there's always a kind of many different force fields of power operating. And I think, you know, part of my impulse for talking about it is that we want to be able to like reflect on these themes in the open. Yeah. We want to be able to actually look at them and acknowledge their place in our practice. Sometimes power is unsupportive. Sometimes it actually is a kind of critical ingredient in growing. And this is something that actually needs to be held in a collaborative way between, you know, sanghas and teachers and, you know, institutions. Because, you know, communities, when communities go sideways, it's sex, money, power, you know. And I think we want to like pull back the veil on the mechanisms of power to assess how it works, how it's working in different communities, in what ways it feels balanced and onward leading, conducive to liberation, in what ways it needs to be evaluated. So, surrender, power, sila. Time for a few questions, if there are any. Yeah, yeah, we'll run the mic. Thanks.
Hello. I have a question that's been that I've been struggling with for quite some time. It's on. Can anyone hear me? No. Yes.
Yeah.
Hello, can you hear me now? Okay, great. So I've been struggling with a question for quite some time. I grew up in a very abusive and addictive family, and I came to California to kind of heal myself. And one thing that happened is I went on retreat. Once, and it was 10 days, and it was very silent, a silent retreat. And somewhere around the third day or so, everyone started to cry. And I mean cry like really cry, like I've never seen before. And I went through the whole retreat, not myself crying. And for years, I've been wondering, is there some did I not surrender? Is there some demon inside of me that I'm just too afraid to let out? So it's a question that I've been really, you know, trying to come to some sort of grips to. And in your experience, I mean, have you seen that sort of experience in retreats yourself? And, you know, what do you think about that?
Yeah. Thank you. So, yeah, a lot of tears in retreat. Quite common for people to have that experience, and there's a way in which the kind of model of Dharma growth is one model that gets emphasized, especially in modern teachings, is this kind of like intensity and crescendo and catharsis and letting go. And that cycle for many people is quite meaningful and important. And at the same time, it's not the only way we grow in Dharma. And if we get too closely identified with that model of sort of like the kind of breaking down and then like insight and release and catharsis and then steadiness or bliss or something, if we get too identified with that as the way we grow in practice, that's problematic, yeah? Because then we almost just start trying to like engineer, subtly like engineer these breakdowns and breakthroughs, and it's hell here and heaven here. And so much of Dharma practice is just this like quiet cultivation and planting seeds that we have the fruit of for some time, and progress that we will not discern until we wake up someday and look back and realize, I don't know when I let that go, but I'm not suffering in the same way that I was. And a lot of the growth that I've seen in Dharma practice, in my own practice, I have no idea when change happened. It's in retrospect that I see like, oh, I know I used to suffer this way or that way. And that is just gone. Yeah. That's one side. The other side, from Ajahn Chah, you know, said to have uttered that our practice begins once we've cried very deeply. Yeah. And I do think that there's a certain kind of, yeah, Adyashanti said, fling you nakedly into such breathtaking poverty. There's something about, it may not look like tears, but there is some kind of deep surrender. To me, the way I experience it, it's like surrendering to the Dhamma, like I don't even care where it's going or what I get or what it's going to do to me. But I want to surrender, you know. Yeah. You know, as I say these things, like, and the more I work with folks, or like on Wednesdays when Gil, or if I'm subbing, like you see people one-on-one, and I see how like highly differentiated my approach is with each person who comes in. And like the person that I am, the things I say, the advice that I give, the teachings I emphasize or de-emphasize, it's like totally different from one person to the next, you know? And it would be like negligent to be the same person with each of the folks, the practitioners. And yet here I'm saying the same thing to all of you, right? And somehow, I guess, it kind of works to give one Dharma talk, to give one response, you know. But, you know, I would say, like, in terms of your own kind of power, like, you really need to pick these things up in ways that are supportive for your own heart and mind, and leave the rest behind. So let's just sit for a moment. So may we surrender to Dharma in whatever ways feel safe. And in doing so, may we find our power. And may we use our power for the welfare and benefit of everyone we encounter. Thank you. Thank you.